prayer's effect on body. Prayer is, as you say, receiving a lot of attention in these times of war and casualties. The other day, as I seated myself in the lounge of a Southern Pacific train, a passenger next to me introduced himself as an Army physician who had just returned after 2 years' practice at the front. In the course of our conversation, he casually remarked, "If people would say their prayers and have faith and do nothing else," and I emphasize this latter, "they would get along all right." Quite naturally, he did not mean to intimate that the time had arrived when doctors and apothecaries could be dispensed with. He was putting forth his conviction that prayer is a definite, and you and I might add, a sufficient, power in the field of therapeutics. Prayer necessarily has a different meaning for different individuals. It will be more intelligent in some than in others. Probably nobody questions the efficacy of the sincere outpourings of the soul, though he may know little of the processes involved. With some, prayer may tend toward the emotional, while with others it will have a slant toward the intellectual. It is safe to say that prayer is generally composite. It involves desire, petition, faith, and finally affirmation of what already is rather than of what is hoped for. Prayer, says Emerson in his essay on self-reliance, is the contemplation of the facts of life from the highest point of view. It is the soliloquy of a beholding and jubilant soul. It is the Spirit of God pronouncing his works good. As soon as the man is at one with God, he will not beg. He will see prayer in all action. Certainly, the metaphysical treatment of the sick is not purely an intellectual process. It involves warmth and fervor. It is permeated with sympathy, comfort, tenderness, compassion, cheer. The metallic thought has little capacity for the alleviation of distress. It is hardly less than astonishing what full confidence in the goodness and readiness of God on the part of the most untutored mentality will do in dissipating pain and affliction. All this is in accord with Isaiah's promise, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear." Why is it, you ask, that a normal mental attitude, a healthful line of thinking and talking, will heal disease? Obviously, because disease is a mental condition, and mental conditions, manifestly, can be changed by mental processes. Every school of medicine recognizes that many ills are mental. Metaphysics insists that they all are. Indeed, it ventures that they are less than mental. They are illusory, having no mentality back of them. But you may argue, "My ailment is in the body, and how can the body be influenced by prayer or by spiritual means?" Well, it can be because the body itself is mental. Does it not talk to you, saying, perhaps, that it hurts, that it is weary, or that it is at ease? But you may contend that the human mind does the talking. Well, what is known as the human mind and the human body are all one and together, are they not? They combine to form that intelligence called a human being. We speak of man as both mind and body, mind being the upper, the more ethereal layer, and body the lower or grosser. But they are both mental, both parts of the same mentality. Change your mentality, your thinking, and necessarily you change your body. Since the body is mental and disease is mental, all types of disease respond to metaphysical or spiritual treatment. Not only is disease mental, it is mesmeric. It seems to be true, yet it is not. Hence its curability. This mesmerism is induced, very largely, by the mistaken assumption that man is a material creature in a material world of danger. But when we keep in thought that God is spirit, we must conclude that, whatever the appearances may be, man is a spiritual creature in the unobstructed realm of spirit, where disasters and diseases cannot lurk. Well, man and the world in which he lives cannot differ in quality from their creator. You are consciousness, not corporeality. Of what are you aware? Aware of life abundant. In this moment, so far as you feel heavy, weary, sick, or in despair, you are mesmerized. How shall we break the mesmerism? Workable recipes may be found in previous letters. Unerring mind controls man, controls you. How then can there be anything in you out of place or out of order? You are the temple of the living God, not the temple of weakness, decrepitude, sickness, but the temple of strength, health, beauty. In other words, you are an epitome of irrepressible life. Indeed, you are irrepressible life exhibited. This spells exemption for you from disability and dissolution. You are the locale of all-knowing mind, diffusing in you the intelligence you need for success and usefulness, the ability to find employment, to make good in your business or profession, to overcome the problems of everyday experience. Have you ever said silently, "I am the temple of the living God"? The place where limitless life and mind are in operation? The place where dullness and distress cannot enter? To talk thus to yourself, instead of rehearsing the trifling or depressing thoughts which try to command attention, is to speak the truth which shatters the mesmerism of suffering or discouragement. And you can, if you will, carry on this rational conversation all day long while about your ordinary work. This is having your conversation in heaven. It is prayer. At this point, you may ask, is the body the temple of the living God? Well, you might better so regard it than to picture it in the resort of sickness. However, we have not been talking or thinking about the body, but about you. And you are immeasurably more than the body. Have we not agreed that you are consciousness, not corporeality? Consciousness is out of the body rather than in it. It inhabits an area so wide that it is anywhere or everywhere at will. If it would contact the crude material world, it must have an instrument. Therefore, it evolves the body, holds it, wields it. When consciousness is normal, unalarmed and unconfused, it constructs a normal body. But when consciousness is confused or mesmerized, it may construct a faulty, even sickly body. When the mind's free, assures Shakespeare in King Lear, the body's delicate. The tempest in my mind doth from my senses take all feeling else save what beats there. How may one normalize consciousness so that it will build better? By thinking out these constructive truths now under consideration. Thereby will consciousness be lifted to the point where it will build a better body. Yes, and a better intellect, for intellect also is a product of consciousness. You are more than a body, more than body and intellect combined. You are an individual consciousness standing back of body and intellect and telling them what to do. It is clear that you order your body to do this, that, and the other task. But it is equally clear that you also direct your intellect to carry on first this and then the other enterprise. Did you not, a moment ago, command intellect to declare, "I am the temple of the living God"? And right now, maybe, you are asking intellect to recall this line from Morta D'Arthur, "Pray for my soul. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of." Body and intellect are yours, your instruments, your servants. Yet they are not you. You are that individual consciousness which rules them. Bodies come and go. This human frame is not the permanent affair it appears. Observe from week to week that mark on your fingernail. Nearer and nearer it approaches the end, until presently mark, nail, and all are gone. A new nail has taken the place. The same process of growth and change in response to the ceaseless urge of life is taking place throughout the body, so that at the end of the year, if we may believe the physiologists, one has an entirely new equipment. Intellect rises and falls. Possibly you have detected this in yourself. Certainly you have observed it in others. You have seen intellect attain such heights in some man that you have stood in awe of him. Ere long you may have seen that proud intellect decline and disintegrate. Human experience knows no tragedy more touching. Intellect rises and wanes. Bodies come and go. But you, the individual consciousness which holds and commands them, go on and on indefinitely, made after the power of endless life. Here is the temple of the living God. And if you even glimpse this sublime picture of yourself, your body will make little trouble. It will behave as well as it did when you were a youngster. Then its behavior was so faultless that you scarcely knew you had a body. Some day, under the influence of these truths we are now working out, you may hope to possess as good a body as Jesus possessed the day he strode through the threatening crowds unseen, or the evening when he stepped into the room where his disciples were gathered behind bolted doors. An individual who can perform such feats is fast growing unto the stature of perfect manhood. He is putting resistances behind. He is emerging into spiritual or genuine consciousness. And spiritual consciousness cannot become unconscious. Hence, the permanence of individual man.